Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dede Guttenplan, editor of the Nation. Roe v. Wade may have been overturned by Donald Trump's Supreme Court, but the conservative effort to destroy any and all abortion access in America rages on. One issue has recently moved to the center of Republican misinformation efforts: later abortions. At the same time, later abortion care has never been more urgent. As state laws tighten access across the country, women seeking safe medical treatment face rising risks. But the right's campaigning has not only deepened public divides, but also sparked tensions within pro-choice groups on the left. So who's leading the fight on the ground? And who's most affected by these political battles? Here to delve into all of these questions is the Nation's abortion access correspondent, Amy Littlefield. Amy is a veteran reporter on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion, and is the author of the forthcoming book, American Crusaders, a history of the anti-abortion movement over the last 50 years. Amy's latest story, Defending All Abortions, is the cover of the June issue of the Nation. Amy, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Nation Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
There's a line from your story that moved me the first time I read it in proof and moves me again each time I read it. So I'm going to read it aloud. It says, "Democrats love to avoid it and Republicans love to lie about it. Even among pro-choice voters, abortions that take place when the fetus looks less like a blob of tissue and more like a baby stir the kind of complex feelings our political discourse seldom accommodates." And I have to say that what grabbed me from the first about your piece is your determination to accommodate all that kind of complexity, which I think you do magnificently, and with, you know, on a topic which is difficult for a lot of people. I will say I went on my own journey reading your piece, but it also sounds like you went on a kind of a journey. So why don't you start with that? What brought you to this topic, and what did reporting on this piece, what impact did reporting this piece have on you?
Thank you so much for saying that. And this piece did have a major impact on me. I went into it wanting to report on the abortions that Republicans love to lie about and Democrats love to avoid. And I had noticed how much of a dividing line later abortions became in the 2024 election. For Republicans, it was their only viable talking point because the public was so angry over the overturn of Roe v. Wade that Republicans like Trump were out there making wild claims about how Democrats supported abortion in the ninth month and wanted to execute babies after birth. Whereas Democrats, even as they leaned into the abortion rights issue in a way that we had never before seen from that party, they seemed more comfortable avoiding the idea that these abortions happened at all. Of course, they are a tiny percentage of all abortions. Abortions that happen in the seventh or eighth month of pregnancy do happen very infrequently, but they're real. And Democrats seem more comfortable avoiding that reality. And then I'd also been watching for years this divide play out within the abortion rights movement. Most of the highly celebrated abortion rights ballot initiatives we've seen after the Supreme Court overturned Roe have allowed states to ban abortions in the later stages of pregnancy. And two of the major leaders in the movement who I spoke with for this story had spoken out against those restrictions and faced so much pushback from their own allies that they had wound up resigning from their leadership positions. And so I was really interested in leaning into that complexity. I'm always really interested in the fault lines in the movement that, you know, sort of determine where movements go from here. And this was a really interesting moment to examine later abortions too, because there's this new generation of providers who are expanding access to this care. You know, some Nation readers might remember the 2013 documentary After Tiller that followed the four doctors who were providing abortions later in pregnancy after George Tiller was assassinated in his Kansas church in 2009. Now, one of the doctors I spoke with estimated there's at least 15 doctors providing that care in clinics and even more in hospitals. And we're seeing that the public seems more sympathetic in the wake of the Dobbs decision overturning Roe to the idea that the government shouldn't be involved in restricting pregnancy at any stage, right? So a recent poll actually found 66% of respondents said the decision to have an abortion in the last 3 months of pregnancy should be between a person and her doctor. At the same time, I can admit that I'm one of the people who feels complicated feelings, right? I've been pregnant. I've carried a pregnancy to term. I've had a baby. I know what it's like to look at an ultrasound, even when it's the size of a lima bean, and feel an attachment to it, right? And it was really interesting in talking with people in my life who are pro-choice, who were like, oh my gosh, you're going there? You're really going to talk about abortions that happen? Why are you doing that? You know? And so I had a lot of feelings and questions in mind when I traveled to Partners in Abortion Care, which is one of the handful of clinics in the country that will provide care in the third trimester of pregnancy.
So let's take a step back and set this a little bit in context. You said that later abortions happened, even though Democrats hate to talk about them, but they're rare. So how rare?
So we know from the existing statistics, which are not perfect, that abortions at or after 21 weeks represent less than 1% of all abortions. So yes, they are uncommon, but they do happen. And when they happen, they tend to be sought by folks who are among the most marginalized people in the country. And so I think that's, yeah.
What are the circumstances that, if there is such a thing as a typical later abortion, lead to someone to seek that care?
Right. So we know from research on people seeking abortions after 24 weeks that there are sort of two pathways to needing an abortion at that stage of pregnancy. One is learning new information. So people might find out really late that they're pregnant, or they might find out later in pregnancy that the fetus has a devastating anomaly, or that they themselves are sick. Maybe they have cancer, or they have some kind of health problem. The other pathway is that they encounter a barrier to abortions earlier in pregnancy. They need to raise money. They need to travel. They, you know, obviously these barriers have multiplied exponentially in the years since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And so those tend to be the two pathways where people wind up needing abortions later in pregnancy.
So if you adopt the old centrist Democrat line that later abortions at least should be safe, legal, and rare, the best way to make them rarer is to remove barriers to earlier care, presumably.
Yes, absolutely. Easing access to earlier abortion care does, you know, provide people, of course, with a greater ability to access care earlier in pregnancy. But I think advocates would also point out that that's not going to obviate the need for abortions later in pregnancy.
Right. Now, there are always going to be people who need them, you know, whether because their own health is at risk or because the fetus isn't viable, but they didn't know until, you know, they wasn't able to detect until late or for, you know, for other reasons. And then I guess the other thing, just to be very clear, because there's so much misinformation on this, is that, you know, I heard Trump say many times during the campaign that the Democrats want to basically legalize infanticide. And there are states, for example, the state that you visit, where later abortions are legal, but there is a limit on how late, even in those states. And how does that work?
Well, the clinic I visited will go up to 34 weeks of pregnancy, and that's in Maryland. This is one of a minority of states where abortion is not banned based on gestational age. And no state allows a doctor to, in Trump's terminology, execute an infant after birth. Okay, that's not a thing. That kind of language is an attempt to demonize and conflate two very different things, right? Infanticide, which is not allowed and not something that the reproductive rights movement is fighting for or has ever fought for, and the right to seek an abortion in the later stages of pregnancy, right? All but nine states and Washington, D.C. do ban abortion at some point, you know, in the later stages of pregnancy. So I went to Maryland, which is one of a minority of states in the country where abortion is allowed in the later stages. And the clinic that I went to, Partners in Abortion Care, is special in that it is a clinic that will offer abortions to anyone who walks in the door up to 34 weeks of pregnancy without any caveats around there has to be a fetal anomaly or there has to be a health complication. And that's the line that they draw.
Well, the other thing that I really respected you for and admired was in leaning into the complexity, the protagonist whom you focus on at first. So let's talk a little bit about her.
So it was really interesting because when I decided to go to one of the few abortion clinics in the country that offers care in the third trimester, I didn't know what patients I was going to meet on that day, right? I knew I was going to spend 3 days in this clinic. I knew I was going to try to talk to anyone who was willing to talk with me. And it just so happened that the patient who I got closest to and was able to spend the most time with as she went through her 3-day procedure was someone who wasn't there because of a fetal anomaly, wasn't there because of a maternal health indication, wasn't there because of one of the catastrophic circumstances that do happen and that we tend to hear about when we hear about abortions later in pregnancy. She was there because she was a mom with 3 kids who had had a really difficult time making a decision about whether to get this abortion. And it had taken her months to decide. And that was the time she needed. And it was interesting because, and I'll tell you more about her circumstances in a minute, but one of the advocates I interviewed for the piece, when I mentioned that the main character in my story was someone who seemed like a little bit of an outlier. She didn't have, you know, new information that had been revealed to her, like a fetal diagnosis later in pregnancy. She hadn't even faced barriers. And that's really exceptional, right? She happened to live in an area that's home to multiple clinics that could provide the care she needed. And she had Medicaid, which would cover the procedure in Maryland. So she was not facing financial barriers and she was not facing travel needs like so many people are today. And the advocate that I was speaking to about this patient, I said, you know, the person I ended up profiling really didn't have any of these tragic circumstances. She just needed a lot of time to make her decision. And the person said to me, good. And I said, why is that good? You know, wouldn't it be easier for the reader to pick up a story about someone with a, you know, fetus that doesn't have a skull and say like, oh, that's an easy one. I support that abortion. And the advocate said to me, no, because telling honest stories about the full range of experiences that are out there helps to lessen the stigma. And sometimes when we only talk about people who need abortions later in pregnancy under tragic circumstances, it can reinforce that stigma rather than easing it. So I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I do want to note that Ayana, the patient who I profile in this piece, is a little bit of an outlier. The Turnaway study, which was a major research project that looked at people who were denied care for abortions because they were too far along, found that there wasn't a significant difference in the amount of time that people needed to make a decision about abortion in the earlier versus later stages of pregnancy. So she may not be the typical person. And yet I do think her story is worth telling. So she's 28 years old. She was 28 weeks pregnant. She is a mom of three. She had been in the Air Force. She went there. She wanted to try and get out of her high school in Washington, D.C. as quickly as possible. So she joined the Air Force. She learned to fly planes, which she said was terrifying at first and then a ton of fun. And then she met a man and fell in love. He didn't want her to go off and join the Air Force, even though she trained for it. And the two of them ended up starting a family. They have three kids together. And between the two of them, they work three jobs to support those kids. So he works for a moving company. She watches her baby in the morning and then goes off to work at a school for kids with autism. And on the weekend, she answers phones at a pizza place while her sister watches her kids.
And in a way, what I admire is that precisely that, you know, we can always find as journalists the easy examples. This seemed to me to be a limit case example. And for that reason, if you let yourself be taken on this journey in this story, I think it will change the way readers think about the whole topic. So that's, in case anybody's interested, that's why I decided to put it on the cover, because I feel like it can have a lot of impact. But let's talk a little bit. Well, there are two things I want to get to. One is George Tiller. I'm glad you mentioned him, but let's remind people what happened and what that did to the abortion movement, the abortion rights or reproductive rights movement in America. So he was a provider who was gunned down in church. Is that right?
That's right. Dr. George Tiller was one of a few doctors who openly provided abortions in the third trimester of pregnancy. His phrase that he liked to use that's been picked up by other people in the movement who carry his legacy was trust women. He trusted his patients to make the decisions and saw them as the experts in their own lives. He worked in Wichita, Kansas, and faced attempts to regulate him out of existence. He was shot and injured while leaving his clinic, was back at work, I think, the next day. You know, he had been raising his arms to flip the middle finger to the person. He thought it was a protest, someone trying to hand him a pamphlet. And then the person shot him, trying to assassinate him. And I think the raising of his arms somehow saved his life, right? So he was a bold figure. And he was assassinated in the lobby of his church in 2009 by a man named Scott Roeder, who was a virulent opponent of abortion. After years during which people in the anti-abortion movement and folks on Fox News had been railing against him as Tiller the killer, Tiller the baby killer. I mean, he was a household name and was vilified within the ranks of the anti-abortion movement for years before his death. In the wake of his assassination, there were four doctors, including Dr. Shelley Sella, who continued the work that he did. Shelley Sella had trained with him, and she is out with a new book that I talk about in my article, reflecting on George Tiller and on her own experience continuing his work and providing third trimester abortions. She was the first woman doctor to do so openly.
And then the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is the way that the reproductive rights movement has been divided on this question. And let's talk a little bit about the Missouri ballot initiative and your reporting on that.
Yeah. So the issue of whether to full-throatedly push for legalized abortion through every, you know, trimester of pregnancy, or the issue of whether to restore Roe or recodify Roe v. Wade, which of course allowed states to ban abortions after viability, has been a dividing line in the movement. And in some ways, we can see it as part of a perennial. You know, I've been working on this book going back to the 1970s. The debate around, do we defend the most marginalized and center their needs, or do we go for what feels politically possible and feasible in this moment and what seems like it'll be popular among a majority of voters? That tension has always been there, whether it's around the issue of funding, public funding of abortion, or whether it's around parental consent for teenagers, or whether it's around abortions after viability, as it is now, right? And viability, we should talk about. Viability is a really slippery line, right? Viability is, in theory, the point in pregnancy at which, after which a fetus can survive outside the womb, which really is dependent on each individual pregnancy, on the person carrying the pregnancy, on where they live, on access to medical care, you know. And so it's a slippery target. What I love about Shelley Sella's book is she puts forward this radical new definition of viability. She talks about viability is something that is in the pregnant person's hands, right? That a pregnancy could become non-viable because the person doesn't have the resources to support it, or because they're in school and they're not able to become a parent in that moment, or because there's an anomaly that literally makes that pregnancy not viable, right? And so she's really arguing for this expansive definition of viability that in some ways harks back to history, right? In the 1800s, we had this other doctrine around quickening. Pregnancy was legal until quickening, which was the moment when a person could feel the fetus move, right? And that was uncomfortable for some male medical professionals because it put the ability to determine the line for determining whether a pregnancy was legal or not in the hands of the pregnant person, right? Most often a woman. And so when doctors began advocating for laws to criminalize abortion as part of their own effort to professionalize and run lay midwives out of business, which we saw, you know, abortion was illegal in every state thanks to these efforts by 1910, then in 1973, Roe v. Wade overturned those laws but established this different doctrine of viability that's determined not by people carrying pregnancies, but by doctors. And so Shelley Sella's definition would put that viability idea back in the hands of doctors.
I hadn't realized two things until I read your piece. One is that the widespread banning of abortion was part of the professionalization of delivering babies. So I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about that. And was it really banned in every state? I didn't know that either. So
Yeah. So, I mean, the original abortion bans were advocated for by male doctors. And this was an era where medicine was not very regulated or respected, right? And where lay midwives were doing a lot of, you know, medical care, right? And so as part of their efforts to professionalize, you know, there were a number of physicians who got involved in a crusade against abortion and succeeded in banning it in every state. And these laws were the ones, of course, that fell when Roe v. Wade in 1973 legalized abortion in every state. Now, some states had been making incremental progress towards reforming those laws, most of them from the 19th century.
So states like New York, which were already legal before Roe, that's because they had previously repealed their turn of the century bans.
That's right. And fun fact, the national NARAL, which is now Reproductive Freedom for All, the original name was the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, because the original abortion rights fight was about repealing those old laws that banned abortion.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. So returning to the divide in the movement, I think it's interesting. You present it very fairly, and you could still sort of see both sides of this. In other words, in Missouri, you quote someone who said, if we really try to throw the most vulnerable people under the bus as a movement, then what the hell is our movement doing? So that's someone advocating for a more expansive referendum than the one they actually put on the ballot, one which would legalize all later abortions. But you also report that when the more restrictive referendum was on the ballot, it only passed by 3 points. So, you know, the people who advocated for the more restrictive referendum might well have been making an accurate political judgment about what they could pass in Missouri. So I wondered how you thought about that and how you think we ought to think about that going forward.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that. And that quote about if we are willing to throw the most vulnerable people under the bus as a movement, then what the hell is our movement doing? It comes from Dr. Diane Horvath, who's the co-owner of Partners, the clinic I visited. But that sentiment really was picked up by folks in Missouri. This was the first state to ban abortion after the Dobbs decision. And advocates there quickly started mobilizing for a constitutional amendment that would restore abortion access in the state. And there was a real divide, which I think was happening in many states that were considering these initiatives, as well as at the national level, around, do we go all out and try to restore, you know, protect abortion access at every stage of pregnancy, or do we allow the state to ban abortions after viability? Polling for years has always shown that abortions become less popular as pregnancies advance. Now, you have to understand, most people don't really understand how pregnancy works or how abortion works. And so that's always a caveat. Any campaign is always partly about educating the public around that, right? And so one of the things I was able to research for this story is internal polling done by strategists in Missouri that showed they were considering a version allowing the state to ban abortions after viability and another version allowing no gestational limit. What's interesting is the more restrictive version did marginally better, according to the strategist who produced this information, by 2 to 4 percentage points, thanks to older and GOP voters, while those most likely to need an abortion, so younger people and people of color, were more likely to support the measure with no gestational limit. So as you point out, of course, on election day, this ends up passing by 3 percentage points. So, you know, it's not exactly a sweeping margin there. And I should mention, they did go with the version that allowed the viability limit. And, you know, so Mallory Swartz, who I spoke with, executive director of Abortion Action Missouri, said, you know, this was the measure that would allow us to have the legal teeth to be effective in Missouri, which is a hostile state in terms of the, you know, judiciary and state regulators, and that it met Missourians where they are. I mean, she heard a lot of myths repeated back to her at the doors when she was talking to voters, even from pro-choice people, about abortion up until the moment of birth and not wanting to allow that. But other folks, including Colleen McNicholas, who was the chief medical officer at the St. Louis Planned Parenthood affiliate, really disagreed with that. She thought, you know what? The public is outraged over Dobbs. If this isn't the moment to go all in and come up with a new paradigm that's better than Roe and that will protect everybody, then when are we going to do it? And she told me it felt like an opportunity to live our values, meaning the values of the movement and the things we put on t-shirts and billboards. She winds up refusing to go along with endorsing this ballot initiative. And as a result, there was a smear campaign against her. I mean, I got, you know, lengthy anonymous notes from critics within the state that were criticizing her, accusing her of, you know, undermining a campaign. And that kind of backlash contributed to her decision to leave the Planned Parenthood affiliate in January. So that's sort of an example of how these tensions and divides within the movement got pretty ugly at times.
Well, I mean, I think it's a topic where there are very hard questions, both in individual people's lives and also within the movement. I mean, and, you know, again, it's a tribute to your reporting that you've, to me, at least convincingly, fairly report both sides of those questions. You know, if it had passed by 6 or 10%, you could have said, oh, they could have gone for more and gotten it. But, you know, this is a case where, if you're inclined to think they made the right choice, there's certainly factual material to support that view. And on the other hand, the other argument is still there and an appealing one for people who want to expand women's reproductive rights. So I think it's, you know, it's also clear that this is going to be the live battleground for some time to come. And I wondered what you see as on the horizon that we should be paying attention to.
Well, I think we're going to continue to see abortion rights ballot initiatives in the states. But I think one of the major takeaways from the 2024 election is that those abortion rights ballot initiatives really didn't translate into wins for Democratic politicians up and down the ballot in the way that people in, you know, Democratic aligned strategists had hoped, right? And also, as we've seen in Missouri, I mean, they did end up passing this ballot initiative. And yet, when I was looking into what access actually really looks like right now, and they fought a really hard legal battle to actually put into practice what voters in the state supported, there, it takes a long time, as it turns out, to restart abortion care after it's been turned off. It's not like a light switch that you can just flip on and off. And so we found that a lot of folks in Missouri are still being referred to clinics outside the state as they were before, even though this ballot initiative passed. So it's, they're certainly not cure-alls, you know. I think they'll continue to be successful because when voters have the opportunity to vote directly on abortion, they tend to vote for the pro-choice position. But I think, you know, having spent Election Day reporting for The Nation in Amarillo, Texas, where voters in one of the reddest parts of the country defeated an anti-abortion ballot initiative and yet voted for, guess who, Donald Trump, I think it's a really complicated question. And I think in some ways, these abortion ballot initiatives were framed. They framed abortion as a conservative issue, right? They framed it as, let's get the government out of personal decisions. And that is the sort of language that, if you take it to its logical conclusion, allows no abortion restrictions, right? If the government needs to get out, then they need to get out. So that means they need to get out in the third trimester too, right? And sort of the most promising messaging coming out of the folks who want to repeal all restrictions is around the hostility that people feel towards government interference in pregnancy, right? And I think that's a tricky line, honestly, to tread, because we saw, I mean, that sort of anti-government populism has also empowered the rise of our current, you know, president. So I'm really interested in those tensions as well and how they play out.
Well, that also brings us to another issue that in a way divided the movement for decades, which is public funding, you know, because you can't say the government should get out of the business of women's health care decisions and then say, but the government should pay for it. And, you know, this was one of the Hyde Amendment, and repealing the Hyde Amendment was a flashpoint between mostly white middle-class feminists and feminists of color for decades.
That's exactly right. And I am so glad you brought up the Hyde Amendment, which, you know, stay tuned for my book in 2026. The Hyde Amendment is the main focus. And these tensions are really familiar, right, in terms of the folks who are pushing for full restoration of public funding and the folks who are reading the political tea leaves and saying, that's not going to pass Congress. We don't have the votes, you know. And those tensions have played out for decades in the anti-abortion movement. And, you know, the folks that I talk to, the strategists who are pushing to, you know, protect abortions later in pregnancy and to repeal restrictions around that, they would say that voters can tell the difference. Voters can say no government interference leading to criminalization, that voters don't want people to be locked up for their pregnancy outcomes, which is already happening, right? There's a new report from Pregnancy Justice about how the viability line that we've seen in a lot of these ballot initiatives may be inadvertently fueling criminalization, because a lot of the criminalization cases have been in states that have expansively interpreted the personhood of viable fetuses. So, you know, there's that whole element of it too. I mean, so some strategists would say voters can tell the difference between, you know, government interference leading to criminalization and locking up pregnant people and the doctors who care for them, and then benevolent government interference in the form of public funding. And yet, you know, I wonder if that's really been the case. I mean, Will Salatin's book, Bearing Right, shows how this logic of getting the government out has been turned against the pro-choice movement, has been used to advocate for things like public funding bans.
Well, and also, I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that the opposition in this case has been pretty adept. I mean, just this morning, we saw one of Trump's officials saying that they had no plans to restrict pharmaceutical abortions. And I thought that's interesting that that's a fight that they seem to be inclined to duck, and to actually duck it, you know, because I'm sure they're coming under pressure from their base not to duck it. But Trump or whoever makes the decisions on these questions seems to have decided that's a losing battle.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And of course, the Trump administration has, you know, most recently done what many people did not expect them to do in this lawsuit concerning the future of medication abortion. So this is a lawsuit brought by attorneys general in Kansas, Missouri, and Idaho, who are demanding the FDA roll back measures that eased the access to medication abortion, which now accounts for about 2/3 of abortions in the country that we can count. And many expected the Trump administration to side with the states, right? Ideologically, that would be consistent with their position. And instead, they've weighed in favor of the Biden administration's efforts to dismiss the case. But, you know, HuffPost spoke to Julia Kay at the ACLU, who said there might be a cynical reason they're doing this, right? Which is that they're facing a slew of lawsuits from Democratic states, and they may be trying to stay consistent in their legal arguments against the idea that states have the right to intervene in federal regulations. So I don't think we should interpret from this that the Trump administration has suddenly become pro-choice. You know, I would never try to predict what the Trump administration is going to do. Like, I don't think that's a winning position to take right now. I think Trump does what serves his interests. I think certainly we saw him backpedaling or trying to look like he was backpedaling on abortion in the campaign, right? Even though he was the president responsible for the fall of Roe v. Wade. Because he could read the polls and he knew that voters were by and large outraged over this. And he knew that there were a lot of Republican and independent, you know, voters out there who were pro-choice. And so I think it hasn't, obviously restricting abortion hasn't been his top priority in the first 100 days, but I don't think that means that it's not in the cards, especially since, as you point out, he's receiving massive amounts of pressure from anti-abortion groups to do everything from, you know, help implement a de facto nationwide abortion ban in the form of the 1873 Comstock Act, which is already on the books, wouldn't require, you know, Congress or public consent in this moment, to, you know, some kind of executive order or pressuring Congress to pass some sort of ban on abortions later in pregnancy. So I don't think we should assume that Trump has suddenly had a change of heart on the issue.
No, nor should we assume that it's safe to, as it were, get off the streets. I mean, I think, you know, reading the polls, it only works as a strategy if you can produce the public outrage and presence that keep the polls on our side. So in your story, you talk quite a lot about Ayanna and one other woman. And I'd like to ask two questions in closing. One is how you got them to talk to you. And the second is how they're both doing.
Yeah, thanks for that. So I spoke with Ayanna, who is a 28-year-old mom of three seeking an abortion at 28 weeks. And one of the things I want to say about her is, you know, we talked about how she needed a long time to make her decision. In states where there have been, for example, 6-week bans, I think doctors have reported people rushing to make decisions on abortion, and that can actually lead to really devastating outcomes where people make a decision before they've had time to think about it and then later regret it or sort of haven't gone through the process they needed to. By the time I met Ayanna, she was so sure of her decision that she was like radiating this calm. Like she was so even keel the whole way through. And I have to think that's at least partly because she had had the time she needed to think about it. I got both of these patients to talk with me by explaining what I was doing, that I was out to understand more deeply the reasons why people seek abortions at that stage of pregnancy and to try to combat the misinformation out there about it and to try to help people who might be in their position who had questions. And both of them really seemed to get that. The second woman was a woman named Scarlett. She was a young Black mom. She was in some ways more typical in that she didn't find out she was pregnant until late. She didn't find out she was pregnant until she was 16 weeks. She needed to travel from a state that by the time she had made her decision, they didn't have any clinics where she could be seen. She had to raise $12,000 to pay for the procedure, which people often do through a combination of clinic discounts and abortion funds. And she already had a baby at home. She was a typical abortion patient in that most people who seek abortions are already moms. And I was there during the injection that ends the pregnancy. This is always the first step in a later abortion, despite the, you know, claims about ripping live babies apart that Republicans like to make. The first thing that happens is an injection to the fetal heart that ends the pregnancy. She was, you know, laying on the table talking about her baby while the injection was performed. And she was, you know, really, she was religious, Christian, and really struggling with this being her second abortion. And I captured this really tender scene where the doctor, Jenny Villavicencio, who's raised Catholic, told her, you know, any God I believe in knows your heart and knows you're a good mom. And, you know, I thought it was really a touching moment of reassurance. So that was Scarlett. And, you know, she told me when she was leaving, you know, she was like, I'm doing okay now. I'm still going to think about it, but I'm okay. And Ayanna, you know, the thing, I've stayed in touch with Ayanna since the article. She seems to be doing really well. The thing that I really noticed about her at the end of 3 days of being with her through the whole abortion procedure, so through the injection to end the pregnancy, then the dilation of the cervix, which can take 1 to 2 days, and then the actual procedure itself. When she was done, there was this sort of lightness to her body language. And Dr. Shelley Sella in her book talks about that, how patients sort of almost seem like they're more of themselves, that there's this lightness, this, you know, change in their facial expression after they've ended an unwanted pregnancy. And she says it makes sense. They've been relieved of a huge physical and emotional burden, and it shows. And that's something I really noticed about her, that after she had gone through with the decision and had had the time to really think about it and make sure it was the right choice, she seemed to have this sort of lightness to her bearing as she went back out into the world.
Okay, well, I think that's a great note to end on. You can read Amy's piece in the June issue of The Nation. And thanks so much for coming on The Nation podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.